A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 371. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are talking about Out of This World, Little Lost Robot. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
Little Lost Robot is the only surviving episode from the anthology series Out of This World. It was broadcast way back in 1962, so this was an early science fiction anthology series for British television, and it was about a 52-minute episode in black and white, of course.
And it's a fascinating episode for us to look at because it gives us a chance to talk about an adaptation of one of Isaac Asimov's famous robot stories. And it's also a huge opportunity to see the only surviving episode of this early science fiction series. Quite an interesting series, as we'll talk about, particularly for some of the people involved behind the camera, as it were, when we get to that, Brian. But yeah, it's fascinating. Isaac Asimov and a great early bit of science fiction British television.
Yes, absolutely. And this series, Out of This World, was one that adapted a lot of stories from these well-known authors like Asimov.
So let's start with the setup. Amazingly, as I noticed on my rewatch yesterday, this is set in 2021, no less, and on Hyperbase 7, somewhere out near Saturn, engineers are working on new hyperdrive technology, but they have a problem with one of their Nestor robots that is quite obviously important to the plot and in the title.
Yes, a casual remark from one of the scientists telling a robot to get lost has caused this robot to conceal itself among a shipment of apparently identical robots that are about to be sent to another base somewhere else. But there is, of course, something that is not identical, that is special and unique about this robot, that could lead to a disaster if it gets into the population, so to speak, if it escapes out into the world beyond.
So when they need to identify this rogue robot, the base commanders have put out the call for, they've sent for the leading robot psychologist for help in identifying the missing machine. And that's really the start of our story and introduces us to some very important key characters that we're about to get to.
Yes, absolutely.
So let's start with the robot psychologist, Dr. Susan Calvin, here played by Maxine Audley, who had a long career, including the film Peeping Tom. She was in episodes of Danger Man, the Patrick McGoohan series. She did one of the Hammer Frankenstein movies. And here she is, the leading expert on robot intelligence, the psychology of robots, and particularly the three laws of robotics. And if you know the Asimov stories, you'll know what an important character Dr. Susan Calvin is. And we think probably this is her first representation on screen, Brian.
Yes, I'm certainly not aware of any earlier adaptations. Major General Colner, played by Clifford Evans, who shows up in the Avengers and in the Champions. He is the base commander, intrigued by the challenge of the situation and by this expert that Earth has sent to him. And he is also working on this side project of growing oxygenated roses. So he's doing a little bit of gardening on a space station in his spare time.
A space-based commander's got to have a side project. Got to have a hobby, Brian.
Of course.
We've also got some other scientists on the base. Peter Bogert, played by Murray Hayne, again from appeared in The Avengers. He is the lead scientist on the base. And it's suggested, I think, in this adaptation that there might have been a previous relationship between him and Susan Calvin. He is also a recurring character in the Isaac Asimov robot stories. In the stories, he's a mathematician, and he has a sort of, again, a keen scientific interest in trying to solve this problem, and recognizes that Susan Calvin is probably the best chance they've got.
Black is played by Gerald Flood, who we have seen in Pathfinders in Space and the City Below the Sea series. He was also, much later, Chameleon and King John in Doctor Who, most notably in The King's Demons. And he's always an entertaining figure to see whenever he shows up. So Black is an engineer. He's the one who made this comment that started the whole incident. And he is rather dismissive and sort of irritated about a lot of this stuff and seems to be not as much on side with using all of these robots as some of the others are.
Yes, has a rather sort of blunt and irritated approach to dealing with the robots, and finds the whole process rather irritating, it seems, doesn't he?
Yes, I think that role was sort of saved by the fact that they had Gerald Flood playing him.
Absolutely, yes. We've got the robot itself, Nestor 10, I believe. The man in the suit we know is Roger Snowden. I don't know if he was doing the voice of the robots as well, but he certainly appears as the person in the suit. And yeah, it's a challenge for the actors in the robot suits, but we'll get to that as we go along.
We also have a presenter, someone who introduces the stories in Out of This World, much like in the US you had for The Twilight Zone and Alfred Hitchcock Presents. You had someone introducing the stories at the beginning and often saying something at the end. And here it was Boris Karloff. So we have a nice little introduction from Boris Karloff, and he did that for all of the Out of This World episodes.
How wonderful to see Boris Karloff on our screens and to have this little moment of him introducing and then giving the sort of the epilogue final closing in the last moments. So yeah, great to see Boris Karloff on screen in this, Brian.
Yes, and nice to see a sort of tone-setting thing like that in a British anthology series, being so used to it from some American ones.
Absolutely. So let's deal with Isaac Asimov's laws of robotics, the famous three laws from his iRobot stories, which this, of course, this story includes. So I'll state them. Law one, a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Law two, a robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And the third law, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first and second laws.
Yes, and this is, of course, a central set of concepts to the entire robot series of stories. And it is pivotal to this story as well. On Hyperbase 7, these scientists are working with potentially harmful gamma rays. So they are using these Nestor robots to separate the scientists from their experiments so the robots can get in and do the things that have the radiation present. So because of this, robot Nestor 10 has a modified version of Rule 1, which does not quite include the allow a human being to come to harm clause. So still no direct action, but the doing something that might allow a human to come to harm, that part has been disabled, it seems. And Dr. Susan Calvin is horrified when she hears about this, that this was done, and it was done without her knowledge. And the idea that this robot might escape and be used for other things, you know, in this planned shipment, is quite terrifying for her.
Yes, I presume the problem was that the robots, whenever he sensed gamma rays around, would try to remove the human scientists from the experimental area and thus kept interfering with the experiments. So I guess that's why they introduced this weakened version of the first law into Nesta 10.
Or they would stop the experiment from being run altogether to avoid the potential of humans being harmed by the radiation.
I guess so. And of course, as you say, Dr. Calvin absolutely incensed by this. She believes the three laws are fundamental to safe working with robots. And so much so that she would rather destroy all of the 21 identical Nesta robots rather than allow one robot with a modified first law escape to another base. But of course, Hyperbase 7, these robots are extremely expensive. The shipment that's arrived and is going to go on to another base is extremely valuable. So they are desperate to find a solution to this puzzle and persuade Dr. Calvin to use her knowledge of robot psychology, I guess, to identify the missing robot.
Yes, the robots are valuable enough that running a whole experimental scenario, you know, running a project in order to figure out what is going on and be able to keep the other 20 robots, which are okay, it's worth doing all of that because they're sufficiently valuable.
And I should mention that it appears that Dr. Calvin, in this version of the story, is the inventor of the three laws of robotics, which I don't think is the case in the Asimov stories originally. And I also noted that they do specify the first law, but they don't really spend a lot of time either stating the second and third laws or talking about them. But we'll get into that and a bit more in our next episode.
Yes, they do very much set up that the laws are very important, but they don't go into the details of the laws themselves in as much as you might expect. So we should get to our production notes. Isaac Asimov, born 1920, died 1992. Sometimes referred to as one of the big three sci-fi authors from the first half of the 20th century, Robert Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke being the other two. He is most famous for the Foundation stories and for the Robot series. The Robot series being made up of 37 short stories and 6 novels. It started with a story called Robbie, which was first published in September 1940 in an issue of Super Science Stories, which was a science fiction magazine running at the time. And that story, usually called Robbie, or in that magazine, it was actually called Strange Playfellows, but normally known as Robbie, that came out all the way back then in 1940.
And the series runs up to 1985 and finishes with the novel Robots and Empire. And Little Lost Robot is the 6th robot story, originally published in 1947 in Astounding Science Fiction magazine. And of course, you're probably familiar with this, that Isaac Asimov then collected later on all of or a number of his robot stories and put them together with a sort of linking narrative into what I believe is known as a fix-up novel, Brian. This one was called, of course, I, Robot, which collects most of his robot stories.
Yes, and of course, there was something similar with the Foundation stories that Asimov did as well in the 1950s. So all of these stories deal with these robots that have a positronic brain and are set in the early space exploration period of the late 20th century and into the 21st century. And of course, when these stories were new, the idea of positrons, the positron being the antiparticle for the electron, that was sort of a hot new idea in science and being talked about a lot. So the idea of an artificial brain used that and became the positronic brain. which was an idea that Asimov introduced.
And a fascinating idea, one that has crossed over into other media, as we'll mention in a moment as well.
Oh yes, for sure. The stories deal with interpretations of the three laws and how they can break down and the logic puzzles that they create that follow on from them. And those are things that are often solved by Dr. Calvin, who features in the linking narrative recounting these stories from her career talking to a journalist. And yes, the positronic brain from Asimov's stories shows up in Doctor Who, in Evil of the Daleks. It shows up in Star Trek with Lieutenant Commander Data. It shows up in the Marvel comics with the Vision. It's even in the Alien movies. It sort of becomes something that's used in science fiction when talking about intelligence for something that is an artificial brain.
Yes, convenient shorthand, I guess, adapted from Asimov, the positronic brain, all forms of artificial intelligence.
Yes, indeed.
So let's get on to how this story came to the screen in the early 60s. We start with a very familiar name, Sidney Newman, of course, then the producer at ABC Television for ITV. And he had worked with Irene Shubik, a name we've also mentioned before, a producer, a science fiction fan, a story and script editor, who had suggested to Sidney Newman a science fiction version of their popular TV series Armchair Theatre back in 1961. And she had managed to get some slightly science fiction sort of tinged stories into the run of Armchair Theatre. So she was well known as a fan of this stuff. And I think we have her to thank in a way for convincing Sidney Newman of the sort of, you know, the merit of putting these shows on TV.
Yes, I think that's right. It's also possible that the BBC's success with A for Andromeda, which came out in 1961, we covered that in British Invaders 43 and 44, that convinced Sidney Newman to go ahead with doing a science fiction project, because clearly science fiction on television was something that people were watching. Shubik was appointed as story editor, and Newman turned to Leonard White from The Avengers to produce. Shubik later said that she considered hundreds of stories, but often ran into copyright dead ends. So right from the beginning, they were looking at adapting existing stories, but yeah, they couldn't always get the rights for those.
And it's fascinating to think of the sort of canon of science fiction and science fiction short stories that she was considering, and going through all this stuff to actually try and identify them and to get permission to use them. And we know that she had help from a well-known figure in the British science fiction publication business, a name, John Carnell, who was the founder of New Worlds magazine. He was a science fiction publisher, and he was the one who often had the contacts for the authors and could get Irene Shubik in touch with them and then get through some of the permissions and the licensing to actually adapt their stories. That's probably, again, another sort of vital partnership that brings these stories to us.
Yes, at the time, the science fiction magazines were such a big thing. I imagine Irene Shubik was there with an enormous stack of magazines from the 1940s and 50s, going through those looking for potential stories.
And interestingly, we often mention television strikes when we talk about some of these 60s and 70s programs. There was an equity strike which delayed production of Armchair Theatre, and that's often mentioned as giving Irene Shubik more time to work on this Out of This World project, finding the stories, securing the rights, and getting it ready for, I guess, presentation to Newman and to Leonard White. Now, we mentioned that this is unusual in it, a British show with a host. Sidney Newman was quite taken with this idea, particularly because Donald Pleasance had done an earlier sort of crime spin-off called Armchair Mystery Thriller, and Donald Pleasance had introduced those stories. So they looked for a host for these stories as well.
Yes, and Boris Karloff had already done a horror host type job for an American TV anthology series called Thriller, and he had returned to live in England in 1959, so he was secured to do the introductions for this new series. The 14 stories chosen, they did a run of 14. They included works by John Wyndham and Clifford D. Simak and Philip K. Dick. And some of those adaptations were by Clive Exton and Terry Nation. And Terry Nation also contributed an original story called Botany Bay. So we had lots of interesting writers involved here.
Absolutely. Some great names. I mean, it's just amazing the caliber of people that were involved.
The first story for it was Dumb Martian by John Wyndham. But what Sidney Newman decided was to release it as the final episode of Armchair Thriller. So you had the epilogue by Karloff and introducing the new series. So it was almost doubling as the end of one series and the beginning of another series, sort of tying these things together.
Sounds like a bit of classic Sidney Newman in a way, doesn't it? Very, very savvy about marketing this stuff and building an audience for a new show.
It does, yeah.
So, Little Lost Robot is the second episode of the series and adapted for the screen from the Asimov story by Leo Lehman, who also wrote an episode of the anthology series Dead of Night, which we recently covered, although his episode is one of the lost ones. Directed for the screen by Guy Verney, who we know from Pathfinders in Space and from The Avengers. And the budget at the time, quite a huge £5,000 was the budget, and required 21 robot costumes, as well as a complicated fall-in platform device, which is sort of integral to the story. I think the original short story of Asimov mentions 60 robots, but I suspect that was slightly too much for both the costumes and to fit them all on set at the same time. So they went with 21.
Yes, that would be difficult to do as a production of the type that they were doing, but they did put together a pretty impressive production here.
And according to the DVD commentary, which we'll mention in a moment, a couple of the robot actors, the men inside the suits, were complaining about the heat and discomfort of wearing the unwieldy outfits, which apparently led Boris Karloff to tell them off for moaning. And I guess, Brian, he would know about hot and unwieldy outfits and makeup.
Yes, he would, wouldn't he?
I mean, unfortunately, the only bit of Boris Karloff we've got to see is his intro and outro to this episode, although I have seen a couple of still pictures of him from other episodes where it does seem like he is possibly on the set for the episodes. So it is possible that he wasn't just filming all of his intros and outros in one day. He might have actually turned up on the set of the episodes. But I don't know if this is a true or apocryphal story. It is a great one to associate with Karloff, of course.
Yes, that is lovely. And there was more of a theatrical company kind of feel to television productions at the time. So it's conceivable.
Yeah.
Little Lost Robot was broadcast on Saturday, July 7th, 1962 at 10 p.m., which was the regular weekly slot for the show. The series was well-reviewed at the time, being described as some of the most intelligent science fiction on British television since Quatermass, and the ratings were strong as well. It unfortunately did not get a second series. It only had the one. And that may have been because Sidney Newman moved to the BBC. He got a big position there in the early 60s.
And we all know what happened next, but we also know that Irene Shubik followed him as well to BBC and would then go on to produce Out of the Unknown in 1965. Which did become a much longer anthology science fiction series on the BBC. We covered it in British Invaders 135 and 136. So yes, it did, in a way, I suppose you could say that this idea continued on the BBC.
Yes, it did, without the Karloff introductions, but with Sidney Newman and Irene Shubik both involved. And that series also has a number of missing episodes, but quite a few of them do survive.
However, sadly, for Out of This World, this one series, the only episode that is known to survive is, of course, this one, Little Lost Robot. We know that several episodes were recorded on videotape because of some of the special effects involved in making them. You know, there was a certain amount of live-to-air television in those days as well. But of course, those videotapes, we also know, are extremely valuable and expensive, and therefore were often wiped and reused. And somehow or other, this one survives, because all the other episodes are gone, Brian, or it seems.
Yes, there was a 35mm telerecording of this that was made, and it survived. So we have it because of that. And it's not entirely clear why there was a telerecording and why it survived, but in this case it did, which is good for us now.
Absolutely.
It's also interesting to note that Sidney Newman did a couple of major moves with having women working on his production teams, with first Irene Shubik and then Verity Lambert, when Sidney Newman, of course, created Doctor Who, and Lambert was its first producer. And then he worked again with Irene Shubik on Out of the Unknown. So it was interesting that he was doing that when very few television executives were at that point.
And how appropriate that this episode features, of course, the famous Dr. Susan Calvin, one of the most, you know, major figures from the literature of the early 20th century in science fiction. So yes, it seems very appropriate. Sidney Newman being very progressive in having women in such important parts in television production at the time.
Yes, absolutely. So we should get to the availability on this.
Here in Region 2, I have been watching a BFI DVD release from 2014. Quite a few bits and pieces, as we'd expect from a BFI release. It includes the regular film transfer, a vidfire version, which I don't understand too much, but sort of, as far as I can tell, it gives you a similar viewing experience to what you would have seen in 1962, I think, Brian.
It is designed to make it look more like video and less like film. So the idea is that we're getting something that looks a little bit different because it's gone through this film step. And vidfire tries to make it look more like something that hadn't gone through that, and more like what would have been broadcast originally. Whether it actually does look more like what was originally broadcast is hard to say.
Okay, but you can watch both versions, and you can watch a third version, which has a commentary track moderated by Toby Haydock, featuring fan and expert on the series, Mark Ward, but most notably the producer, Leonard White, does a commentary track with them and talks about the series and some of the production details and that story of Boris Karloff telling off the actors for moaning about the robot suits.
Of course, you can't leave that out.
And you also get the audio of two other episodes which were recorded off-air by fans. That's Cold Equations and Imposter, which I'll mention again in our next episode. Plus, you get a PDF of the script for Dumb Martian, the first episode, and a production notes booklet with information about the restoration, the format of the episodes, and, of course, some details about the series itself. And all for a mere £8 or so at the moment, which is a bargain. And if you're just interested in watching the show alone and don't want the extras, but you want to support the BFI in putting out these releases, you can buy the episode for a mere £2.50 on the BFI player over here. So that's the situation. Quite a nice release, which I've been looking at and is sitting here in front of me. Brian, what about yourself?
Well, in Region 1, there is no release. So what you're looking at, if you're in North America, is importing the BFI release from the UK. And, you know, that's a Region 2 release, of course. And of course, the book iRobot from Isaac Asimov is still in print and widely available, as are the other books in the Robot series.
And strangely enough, I have read them this time, and I went back and reread Little Lost Robot for this episode. So I'm up to date on that particular one. And yeah, the robot stories, great fun as logic puzzles. So that'll do us for our first episode. We've got through a lot, but we've got more to talk about next time. We're going to talk a little bit about the logic puzzle that Susan Calvin has to solve in Little Lost Robot. And we're going to talk a bit more about this series itself and perhaps what is lost to us.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, we will also do our own reviews and recommendations and talk about this DVD release. Until then, you can find all of our previous episodes, 370 of them, at BritishInvaders.com. And if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find our group there. And we always have some fun things to talk about there.
Indeed we do. Come along and join the fun. And also find British Invaders as part of the Voice of Geeks Network, which you can locate at VogNetwork.com. We're not lost. We're definitely there, as well as on Facebook and on the website.
Absolutely. So thank you for listening. And this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. Until next time, Eamon in England also signing off.